Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
So, tyrannical machines, these are educational practices that have gone wrong and that we find it very difficult to set right. Educational practices that had the best motivation in the beginning, but now are terribly counterproductive. Mm-hmm. That is an area on which we need to focus attention.
One's attention is supposed to be directed towards one's field, and what one is about, essentially, as a professor, is becoming better and better at whatever discipline it is one professes. My project is facing in the other direction, away from the discipline, away from the field, away from knowledge, and towards the students and the professor himself or herself.
So what you're doing is looking at what goes
Reform and renewal in American education, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Lynn V. Cheney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and with Jane Tompkins, a professor of English at Duke University. First, Lynn Cheney discusses her recent report to the Congress and the Nation, an essay on educational reform entitled Tyrannical Machines. After that, Jane Tompkins will talk about her project at the National Humanities Center, a study of undergraduate teaching that she calls a life in school. Lynn Cheney became chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities in 1986. She's written four major reports to the Congress and the public about the humanities in American society. The most recent of these is entitled Tyrannical Machines. The subtitle is A Report on Educational Practices Gone Wrong and Our Best Hopes for Setting Them Right. Among other topics, Tyrannical Machines examines the relationship between teaching and research, textbooks, testing, and informed choice on the part of parents. Lynn Cheney.
We were at the endowment thinking about the question of why it is that we, all of us, not just those of us at the endowment, but the world at large, can identify the flaws in our educational system and have been able to identify them for years and years and years. Why is it, we were asking, that we can identify these flaws and find ourselves unable to do anything about them? And about that time, I was reading William James's essay, The PhD Octopus, in fact, is the particular essay, and I came across this wonderful metaphor of his in which he talks about what happens when you happen across a good idea, but you embed it, you institutionalize it widely, you give it eternal life, and soon you find yourself unable, even after the idea is turned on you, even after the idea has become counterproductive, you find yourself unable to shrug it off and to move in a new direction.
Well, you put me in mind of an essay that here James is writing at the beginning of the 20th century. I remember starting graduate school and reading a piece by a man named William Arrowsmith called The Shame of the Graduate Schools, and it really frightened me, the decline in teaching, that sort of thing. Now, are we talking about smoke and mirrors here? Teachers continue to teach, and the students continue to process. What is the problem? What are you upset about when you talk about a tyrannical machine in teaching?
Well, in terms of the research machine that drives all of higher education, this is a tendency that has been in place for a long time, and Arrowsmith described it eloquently. I remember a phrase from that particular essay in which he talked about the universities being as uncongenial to teaching as the Mojave Desert is to a clutch of Druid priests.
Right.
It was a very colorful way of describing this difficulty. I think it has only become worse since Arrowsmith wrote about it. Uh-huh. What's happened is research has become the key to prestige.
Well,
not only for individuals, but for institutions. Uh-huh. The individual who wants to have a notable career, the individual who wants promotion at tenure, will do research, will publish, will get that book done. Institutions that want to have prestige in the total system of higher education will have people on their faculties who are stars at doing that. Mm-hmm. Teaching doesn't get you to the same place in terms of prestige. And that force is now so powerful that it's very difficult for any individual or any institution singly to run against it.
Tell me about textbooks, Lynn Cheney. That figures in your study here, Tyrannical Machines. I remember hearing a colleague of mine at the university in Chapel Hill say that he'd come across a history textbook. Puritans are people who wear tall hats and take long trips. What about this?
Pilgrims are people who wander. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's one aspect of what's made textbooks less interesting than they should be, and what's made textbooks very boring. There has been a reluctance, for example, to address the whole role that religion has played as an historical force. Mm-hmm. And so we don't mention that the pilgrims were religiously motivated. We forget to tell people that there was a religious element in the Crusades. We make them sound like expensive shopping expeditions. We don't make clear that the civil rights movement had such strong roots in the black churches. Publishers have been worried about addressing subjects of religion, and so it's disappeared from the textbooks. Things that are controversial have disappeared, which is one way of making textbooks, of making history very boring.
Let me get personal for a moment, Lynn Cheney. How were you educated? Do you remember reading your textbooks? Do you remember becoming involved and passionate about them? Did they make sense to you? What I'm leading you here to is the question of, in the words of some of your critics, nostalgia. That you're looking back to a sort of a golden age of teaching and learning that never really existed. What about this?
Well, in my own case, when I remember why it was that I decided that working hard in school, studying hard, reading passionately, when I found all that interesting was when I encountered wonderful teachers. Mm-hmm. And these were women, for the most part. I remember my Latin teacher in particular, who simply had a passion for communicating knowledge, for enlightening students, for making students understand how exciting the adventures of the mind can be.
Did she scare you or did she inspire you?
Both.
I mean, you look back.
I mean,
on...
she was really tough. Her name was Miss Scheidler, and she took no nonsense. It was the first time I ever took a course. This was a Latin course. First time I'd ever taken a course in which it occurred to me that hard work might be a good idea. I was able to get good grades without working very hard, but in Ms. Scheidler's class, you went beyond simply having to work hard.
Yeah, well, with me, her name was Miss Gottschalk, and it was the same drill in Latin. You mentioned good grades, Lynn Cheney. What about tests and testing, the mechanisms that we use? Well, it reflects this relationship between the teacher and the student. The burden's on the student, of course, but what do you have to say to that?
The primary culprit, the leading tyrannical machine in this area is the Scholastic Aptitude Test. Like most tyrannical machines, it was born out of good intentions. People in the early part of the century said to themselves, well, maybe we should have some kind of test that doesn't depend upon the curriculum. Mm-hmm. In other words, we should have a test that tells you who the good students are, even if they haven't read the books that they're reading in the elite prep schools. And this egalitarian impulse is to be admired. The trouble is we have absolutely put the SAT at the center of our education system. We have made it, if education is a church, we've made it the altar.
Right.
And the test doesn't care mm-hmm. what you've studied. It doesn't care whether students have learned what their teachers have tried to teach them.
Kids get to be good at taking tests rather than at knowing things that...
Well, good at taking this particular test. Yeah. And parents spend an enormous amount of money. The Princeton Review is
right.
One of the best businesses, most flourishing businesses in America right now.
Well, what do you replace it with?
Achievement test.
How do we figure out what kids know if we don't have some centralized or standardized kind of mechanism?
Well, it's not a matter of my not wanting a test. What I want is an achievement test instead of an aptitude test.
Mm-hmm.
This is what every other industrialized nation does.
Something with content, something that
exactly.
speaks to the knowledge of what the kid's supposed to know.
Exactly. You know, the SAT people, to give them credit, recently tried to reform the SAT. And one of the things that many people wanted was to have a written section so that it's not all multiple choice. But there was so much controversy, they simply couldn't do that. So now they're going to have an optional essay. You can write if you choose to write. And when someone asked what students might write about, the answer given by the College Board was this. They might write about the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's a platitude. It's a truism. So our kids, if they choose, can write about a platitude. Meanwhile, in Japan, they're writing about the foreign policy of Afghanistan. In Germany, they're writing about democracy in the Weimar Republic. In France, they're writing about American foreign policy from Jimmy Carter through George Bush. So we really do need to move toward content expansion.
As they say in California, I love your concept, but I'm not sure exactly what's behind it. What we have is a shell that is weak on content, if I read you right, what these kids are bringing to these examinations.
It simply doesn't care whether they have learned what they have been taught in school. The education ease for this is that the exam is curriculum free, and intentionally so.
How partisan has all of this become?
I think it's very bipartisan. One of the most dramatic experiments in choice has been proposed in Wisconsin, where Governor Tommy Thompson, who happens to be a Republican, has been working with a member of the legislature named Polly Williams, who happens to be a Democrat. Not only a Democrat, she led Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign in the state in the last election. So one is at the right end of the spectrum, over there anyway, and the others at the left end. But they have come together to advocate a very adventurous choice experiment, which would give 1,000 youngsters in inner city Milwaukee the opportunity to choose either private or public schooling public funds.
And we can generalize from an example like that. That kind of thing is applicable, in your view, across the board to the problems of American education.
The real point I was trying to make is about bipartisanship. I think you can generalize that across the board there is enormous bipartisan support for these efforts that will free our schools of the tyrannical machines. Mm-hmm. The cooperation between the president and the governors has been remarkable. I think we're clearly moving in the direction of some kind of national testing system, achievement testing. And the person who's leading that panel for the governors is Governor Romer of Colorado, who's a Democrat, but he's being very much supported in these efforts by a Republican administration.
All right, we've got this tyrannical machine out there in front of us. Are you optimistic about what's going to happen in American education? Let me put it to you specifically this way. What would you say to somebody who wants to be a teacher, and at the same time you're warning this person about this horrible tyrannical machine?
I am more optimistic now. It's the early days of Secretary Alexander's tenure at education than I was before he was there, really giving invigoration to a lot of important ideas. The president's commitment to education is absolutely strong, and now with that kind of team in place to implement it, I am feeling more optimistic than I have in a long time.
What do you say to the cynics and the critics who say George Bush is hardly the education president?
I'd say, watch his smoke.
Lynn V. Cheney is chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The most recent of her reports to the Congress and the public about the humanities in American society is entitled Tyrannical Machines, a report on educational practices gone wrong and our best hopes for setting them right. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Reform and Renewal in American Education continues. You'll hear next from Jane Tompkins, a professor of English at Duke University. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Jane Tompkins worked on a study entitled A Life in School. One of the proposals she makes in this project is the movement from what she calls the performance model to the coaching model of teaching. Jane Tompkins.
I mean, in fact, the way research universities are set up, and those are the universities from which most of the fellows at this center come, one's attention is supposed to be directed towards one's field, and what one is about, essentially, as a professor, is becoming better and better at whatever discipline it is one professes. My project is facing in the other direction, away from the discipline, away from the field, away from knowledge, and towards the students and the professor himself or herself.
So what you're doing is looking at what goes on in the classroom, not entirely apart, but mainly, largely apart from what we used to call, in conventional terms, instruction. Unscrewing the top of the kid's head, pouring in a lot of facts and figures, and then having the kid repeat this for you on an exam?
Well, yes and no. I actually am very interested in the kind of instruction that students receive by virtue of being in a room with other people, interacting with them in a certain way, relating to the professor's authority or lack thereof in a certain way, moving around inside an institution, learning what the rules are, and behaving according to a set of conventions, only some of which are conscious in the students' minds and many of which are unconscious.
All right, now do you want to reinforce these conventions? Do you want to dispel them? Are you qualifying them? I mean, to what degree are you a rebel, an iconoclast, or to what degree are you the sort of thoughtful examiner of what's going on there?
Well, I love the role of rebel and iconoclast, but I'm at this point not entirely sure where I'm going to come down. What I want is for people to become a little bit more self-conscious about their roles within the institution, to become a little bit more reflective about what it is they're doing vis-a-vis themselves and their students as experts in some field of knowledge.
Now, I want to applaud you on the one hand and say, boy, that's a noble goal. That really sounds good. I wish my kids had that kind of teacher. On the other hand, it seems to me that we have this ever-present opportunity to lapse over into psychobabble, self-help, this sort of mushy kind of, well, what's going on here? Why isn't my kid learning something in school? How do you meet that kind of charge?
Well, that's very well put, Wayne. And those are exactly the terms that people do use who don't like what I do. let me say that that those terms are only appropriate if one has, I think, a pretty superficial idea of what it means to learn. My notion of what it is that people learn in school, K through graduate school, is not that they ingest either a lot of information or a lot of ideas or even the ability to manipulate ideas. I think that what the primary goal of an education should be the empowerment of the individual. Should be an increasing sense on the part of every student of his or her agency in the world, of his or her ability to engage with the world in ways that are absorbing, fulfilling, and enlarging.
All right, now let me haunt you, Jane Tompkins, with a question that you and I sparred a little bit about several months ago when the Humanities Center class of 1990-1991 opened. I said to you, again, boy, that really sounds great, but you're a full professor. You're tenured. You've got your feet planted over there at Duke University. This all sounds so good, but what about somebody who comes along as an assistant professor who has this sort of agenda or project? Is that going to fly very well when it comes time to get tenure and to make points with the people who are going to keep you there on a permanent basis?
That is the question and indeed the objection that comes back to me all the time when I talk about these ideas. And in fact, it is going to appear in print pretty soon in response to an article that I wrote in College English. And the answer is paradoxical. Of course, it's easy for me, much easier for me, because I don't have anything to lose, you know, to sort of embark on this somewhat idiosyncratic and individualistic approach to education, because in effect, I can't be fired for doing it, and, you know, there's no skin off my nose. On the other hand, the complaint that, you know, that people make, which is that they don't have the freedom to do this, that they're either somebody's looking over their shoulder or they've got too heavy a course load or what have you, is in part an excuse, an apology, because in fact, and just let me go on a little longer here, the most creative and innovative ideas in higher education today are coming from precisely that sector of the hierarchy, which you would expect to be least able to come forward with generative and innovative notions about teaching, namely...
What used to be called the Deadwood?
Not the deadwood, but rather people who teach in large state universities and community colleges who have very heavy course loads, uh-huh. teach lots of composition. It's from particularly people who teach rhetoric and composition that the best thinking has come. These are the people who are the least rewarded for what they do, whose prestige is the lowest in terms of the standard measures of academic success. But it's from this sector that I think the best thinking about reform in higher education mm-hmm. has come. Now, so in effect, I mean, it's not that these people were free. It's not that they didn't have people looking over their shoulder, but I think it was probably, and this is a question I have still to answer in my own work, you know, why is all of the best new stuff coming from these people? I think it's in effect that because they taught under the least favorable circumstances, they had to make their lives worth living, or otherwise they would just burn out completely and mm-hmm. they would have to just, you know, chuck it in, roll over and die.
I want you to give me a concrete sense, Jane Tompkins, of how you would work in the classroom. You teach American literature of the 19th and 20th centuries. Give me a specific handle here. You walk into the class and you say, all right, this semester we're going to read Emily Dickinson or Nathaniel Hawthorne or Harriet Tubman or XYZ. What goes on in that classroom undergirding these notions of teaching that you have been describing for me?
Well, let me answer the question just in an empirical way. As follows. I used to walk into the classroom and talk for 20 minutes to a half an hour or maybe longer about Emily Dickinson or whoever it was, and then we would have some discussion, and either it would go well or it wouldn't go well. Now I do something quite different. I hand out a syllabus at the beginning of the semester. The books are on the syllabus, although now I'm beginning to open the syllabus up, too, for student input. And I describe in the first class the aims of the course and my general philosophy. That is, I try to give everything away at once. And then I ask the students to sign up for two different topics or texts that they think would be of interest to them, and end up with three or four students under each category, under each class session. And those students then become responsible for presenting the material of the day to the class.
Wait a minute. The kids are teaching the class?
You got it.
Oh, the fire alarms are going off. The parents are saying, wait a minute, abdication of professional responsibility. What about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would revert to what I said before, that I think that education takes place optimally when a student is fully engaged intellectually and emotionally with what he or she is doing, and that the way for that engagement to happen is for the student to have responsibility, the fullest possible responsibility for what's going on.
Okay, but Jane, responsibility is not the same thing as knowledge. Enthusiasm is not the same thing as ability. The kid will come in and say, well, here we're going to read a poem by Emily Dickinson and present a reading to you and to his or her classmates that is completely off the wall. And what do you do in that instance? You stand up and say, now, wait a minute, you're wrong. Saying that automatically reverses this whole set of ground rules that you've been describing for
me. But that
me.
Isn't the way it happens.
Okay, what does happen?
First of all, when you have people operating in a group, you don't get off-the-wall stuff, because the way these groups are set up, one of the requirements is that they work together as a group, that they work collectively, that they don't make individual presentations. So already you have a kind of self-correcting mechanism there. Then often the group will come and meet with me before class to get an idea of whether what they have in mind is okay. They'll come and check with me. Sometimes I give them outside reading to do, sometimes not. It depends upon the subject. And then when they come to class after the presentation, they have got to face the questions, comments, objections, criticisms of the rest of the class, which under this model they get. Whereas if I walk in and tell the truth, kids aren't that eager to raise their hand and say, no, you're wrong, Professor
right.
Tompkins. Where if it's only the students who are doing the presentation, the other students are going to feel that they have a perfect right, because they're just as intelligent, if not more intelligent than the presenters, to voice their opinion, which means that the presenters are in the position of having to respond to quite a range of objections uh-huh. to their position. So in effect, they have to really take more responsibility for the subject than they would have to if they were only writing, say, an individual paper on a narrow topic which I gave them, which they chose, submitted only to me.
Yeah, this is like pre-class, pre-class. You're asking them to prepare to be prepared when they walk into your classroom.
Not every day does a student presenting, but in effect, they do have to prepare for every class because they know that the fat is going to be in the fire every day.
Right.
And when that situation arises, people want to have their say. They sort of want to get in on it. They want to be part of it. And so lo and behold, they end up doing the reading so that they can be part of it. And
rather than
out.
Sort of lying back on the edge of the enterprise and waiting for that one moment when they're supposed to stand up there and shine.
Yeah.
Jane Tompkins, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What has this project, I guess is the word, that you're embarked on here, examining what goes on in the classroom. How has it changed your own teaching? What goes on? Do you think you're a better teacher? What kind of self-criticism do you offer yourself that would be helpful to people in your shoes?
Well, what it's done for me is that I have realized how much is already there in the students. That is, I have learned to trust students. By learning how to be quiet myself and not always stepping into the breach, not taking all the responsibility on myself, but in effect having faith that the students will come forth, I have learned that they can and do and will come forth. I know that this sounds somewhat vague and messianic, but from going from a sort of performance model of teaching to a coaching model of teaching, I've discovered the incredible potential and energy and enthusiasm that is there inside every student, and have had the incredible reward of being able to elicit that.
Jane Tompkins teaches in the Department of English at Duke University. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a project entitled A Life in School. Jane Tompkins' most recent book is a study of 19th century American literature, a volume entitled Sensational Designs, available from Oxford University Press. This is Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Reform and Renewal in American Education is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 571. That's program number 571. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, Medicine and Society. Wayne Pond will talk with John Stone, a writer and cardiologist from the Emory University School of Medicine. Dr. Stone will discuss his most recent book, a volume entitled In the Country of Hearts. You'll also hear from James Davis, former president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Davis will offer commentary on medicine and public policy. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Reform and Renewal in American Education, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Lynn V. Cheney of the National Endowment for the Humanities and Jane Tompkins of Duke University. Lynn Cheney discusses Tyrannical Machines, her report to the Congress on educational practices gone wrong. Jane Tompkins discusses the performance model and the coaching model in undergraduate teaching. Reform and Renewal in American Education, this week on Soundings.